Good morning. So, last time we went through the stages our textbook divided up the single cycle processor design into. Just looked at each stage individually and said, okay, how do we handle each instruction for the operations this stage is responsible for? And that usually just involved a small part of the processor. So that was maybe a more tractable way of building our processor. It also helped us think about, oh, where do we need to add muxes and things to generally make decisions in our processor? What are they going to look like? And a lot of it is, well, you know, basically we have one way we want information to move for each instruction, and we have muxes to handle the case where, well, there's two different instructions that want to do two different things. We saw that, well, there's a bunch of stages which sometimes don't do very much. Like, we have a memory stage, which often isn't doing anything because the instructions don't use memory. Or we have our write-back stage, which we have a bunch of instructions where it kind of doesn't do anything. I say kind of, because, well, we still need to send something to the register file. We generally have this pattern that, well, we have these wires in our processor, and they're going to have those. We saw that we had this ALU, and when we were looking at our execute stage, we said, oh, yeah, this is where we're computing all our address computations. So it's, even though it's the arithmetic logic unit, you say, oh, so that's for the arithmetic instructions. It turns out a lot of our instructions need to do address arithmetic. And it's also going to be used for them. And we looked at a whole bunch of special cases. And the big ones we saw in when we were trying to implement the YD664 instruction set was we had to deal with the stack pointer. So that was pretty much always a special case. We needed to use the stack pointer when it wasn't in the instruction, really. We had to be careful about it when we were doing things with the stack, whether it was the old versus new stack pointer. We had to worry about getting the address for call, the return address, namely, that was the address of the following instruction. And we have to, you know, set up our read and write enable data memory, which we kind of didn't explicitly talk about before. Also mentioned, the textbook does this thing, which, you know, is probably a common design idea, but not one which makes much intuitive sense if you're thinking of it. Oh, let's do the simplest way to do this instruction, which is that for our move queue and our move queue, they decided, oh, the way we're going to do this instruction is we're going to take our register or our constant and add zero to it. And that doesn't sound simpler, right? We're doing an additional addition, but the logic they had is, well, we have this ALU, it's always there, it always does something, let's just use it and not have to have two different options for what value we're writing, you know, ALU versus one of the value from the constant or the register. And I believe when we finished up, we looked at sort of looking at our overall design and thinking through, okay, we have all these muxes we set up, what's going to happen for various instructions? We'll do a few more examples of that. And then we'll go on to talking about pipeline. So before I move on, questions about things we covered last time? So looking at the quiz, I decided I probably should go over a few things on the quiz. So one was quiz question two, was saying, okay, if we look at the YD6 instruction set, they're making some choices there which are maybe not the most space efficient. In particular, POP queue is encoded using 2 bytes. The actual information in these 2 bytes is this B to indicate that it's a pop and not like an IR move queue or something like that, and this RA to indicate what register we're popping into. And we could encode that in 1 byte pretty easily. But YD6 didn't do this, and probably the reason our textbook authors didn't do this is they said that would be inconvenient for the processor implementation. And the main source of the inconvenience is that this would be an instruction which now takes the register index from a new part of the instruction that previously wasn't being used for that, and that would be inconvenient. And therefore, the answer to the question was, well, we need to get the register number we write from a new place, because it's now from the first byte of the instruction instead of the second byte, and that would be what the change is. I think a lot of people thought, oh, we have to read RA. We don't have to read a register to write it and pop into RA. It does read a register, but the register reads the stack pointer. Okay, so questions on question 2? And then quiz question 3, I think there was a lot of confusion on the ordering of things that don't depend on the clock cycle. So for reading machine code, this is done by our instruction memory, and our instruction memory takes the program counter as input. It can't, stably give us the machine code until it has that program counter. So that's when it's going to read it. If we have the register file takes a register index's input, which tells it, like, do we want REX or R8 or R9? And once that's available, it can stably give us an output, which is the actual value of that register. Yes, it's going to have something there, but it's not going to be stable until we give it the register number in a stable way. And our register numbers generally come from our instruction machine code. So we need the machine code to be available before the register number is going to be available to the register file. So there is an actual order in between those, even though it's not like writes, where we can look at our clock cycle and say, oh, there's this clock signal, and I can point to a point placed on the clock signal where something happens. That's not true for reads, but for writes, we learn that was true, which is why our writing memory and writing registers, those could happen at basically the same time, because they're all triggered by the same event. They're not triggered by waiting for their inputs. Their inputs will be made earlier, but the actual trigger is this one event, which is synchronized across the entire processor. So questions on sort of the timing of these operations. Okay, and quiz question 4 was asking about adding an immediate to memory move instruction. And it was asking what the value input to the data memory, called mem input in HTLRS, and I think a lot of people confuse this with the address input. So the value input says what to write if we're writing, the address input set says where to write or read from. And the value we're writing in an immediate, that's constant in the instruction, to memory move is going to be the constant from the instruction that's going to come from the instruction memory. Questions? Okay, so so I believe last time we did this example, so let's do here. So here I have our overall processor asking for RM move queue. What are these muxes going to select? So we have our PC mux, we have all these muxes here, the DESD and DESDM, and source B. We have the ALU A and B mux. We have this mux controlling the data memory, value in input, and the address in input. So take a little bit of time, think about what should all these be set to. RM. First question should be, what does this instruction do? Who'd like some more time? You people? Okay, let's start with this box in front of the PC. So this is right here. So who thinks we should select the top inputs? The middle inputs? The bottom inputs? Okay, so this is hopefully the easy one. Why do we want the bottom input? And to see why, well, one thing to think about is What does this instruction want to do as far as what instruction we run next? And there's nothing in sort of our usual specification of the instruction which does that. If we write down what the instruction does, we say, oh, it's memory at D plus RB gets the value of register, I should say, register RB. Let's write this. This is D plus register RB gets the value of register RA. And there's nothing in here which says what's happening to the program counter, but our sort of default thing we do to the program counter is the program counter gets set to point to the next instruction, just PC plus instruction length, which is exactly what's going to be on this wire here. So we want to select that as our next program counter. Okay, so how about for source B? Who thinks we want the top input? Thinks we want the bottom input? Who thinks it doesn't matter? Okay, so everyone thinks we need the top input, and we actually need it. And we can tell that if we look at our instruction description, because we need to read register RB. And there's no other way we could do it. Like, we can't supply it with this design to source A. In your HCL code, you might be able to do that, but not with what I've drawn here. Okay, so how about okay. How about DestM? Who thinks you want the top input? Or DestM, which I have highlighted here, thinks we want the bottom input. Okay. So everyone says the bottom input. And that's, we don't want to write for this instruction. We don't see any case where we're citing a register in our description we have here of what the instruction's supposed to do. And the same is going to therefore be true for Destiny. We're going to select the don't write to anything option. Okay, so how about, let's do our ALU inputs. So this first ALU input, who thinks we want the top input? Okay, the middle input. Couple people, the bottom input. It doesn't matter. Okay, so we have, most people want the top input, and we have some people who want the middle input. And so one thing we can look at is, well, what are these values we're choosing from? So we're choosing whether we send D or the value of register RA into the ALU. So our question should be, what is the ALU doing in this instruction? And well, it's the ALU is for some calculation, and the calculation we have in this instruction is our address calculation. So it's probably going to be doing that. And if we look at this address calculation, even though we do need the value of array in the instruction, we don't need it for the address calculation. So that would be a way I would say probably we don't choose array here, because we have to do an address calculation. The ALU is how we have to do it. The address calculation doesn't want array, but it does want D. And it actually looks like if we look at where we've wired our, you know, constant to, this is the only way we can usefully get D somewhere where we care about it in this design. Look, maybe some other design would have some other options, but not here. So I would select our D's. Okay, so how about the other ALU input? Who wants the top input? Wants the bottom input? Okay, so I think we have pretty good consensus on the top input. Because we need the other thing for that calculation, we need R of RV. We want to add them together. We can in fact do that. That's not a problem. And we have two more boxes. So how about this one here? Do we want the top input? The bottom input? Doesn't matter. Okay, so we want, so most people say we want the bottom input. And a way we can think about this is that, well, our options are PC plus 9, which, or the incremented PC, which we do want, but we don't want it, we want it for the program counter, which we already handled, or the value of register array. And we do need to use the value of register array, and in fact, we want to get it to the data memory, and this is our only way of doing that. So it must be what we're going to use for that. So how about this remaining mux here? The top input is from the ALU. The bottom input is from the register file. So who thinks for this one? So first of all, who thinks it doesn't matter? Okay, so everyone either has no opinion or thinks it matters. Okay, so who thinks it should be from the ALU? Thinks it should be from the register file? Okay, so it should be from the ALU, and we have agreement. That's because we want to use our result of the calculation, not throw it away before we get to the data. So that's the answers. Got some questions on how I went through this, figuring out all our mux settings here. More of these, but probably I think we're comfortable enough that we can move on. I can go through these later, or you can go through these later, and some of them have answers and some of them don't in this slides that will be posted after this. But we have our single cycle processor here, so where we learn that, okay, we can set all these boxes up, so we can just set them up, you know, for whatever instruction we want to configure how it works, and it all happens in a single cycle. And if we think about how this happens, this is actually maybe kind of inefficient. And to talk about how it's inefficient, I'm going to talk about doing something that's not a processor, and that's doing laundry. So here's how I might do laundry. I have two loads of laundry, so I'm going to separate my clothes into the whites and the colors so I don't stain everything, and I'm going to put the whites in the washer. I have a nice fast washer, apparently, according to this timeline, and also a fast dryer. Take them out of, the washer, put them in the dryer, take them out of the dryer, and fold them. Then, done the whites. Now I can do the colors. So I move on to the colors, put them in the washer, wait for that to finish, put them in the dryer, wait for that to finish, put it on the folding table. So probably this is not the way any of you would do two loads of laundry. So what's the difference about what you would actually do if you were doing two loads of laundry? Yeah?
Once the whites are done in the washer,
yeah, so once the whites are done in the washer's free. We can use it for something else. So we want to end up with something more like this timer. Where once the washer's free, I use it for something else. Also, once the dryer's free, I use it for something else. I don't wait for everything to finish. And this sort of idea we can call a pipeline, that we're doing one step of the first thing, moving the first thing to the second step, and then doing the first step of the second thing while we're doing the second step of the first thing. So in this case, we have two loads working simultaneously, and eventually, if we have more than two loads, we can do three loads simultaneously, one load in each of our three steps, rather than having our original idea here that seemed obviously inefficient to many people of let's just do one thing at a time. And if we're thinking about our processor is taking this first design right now, that we first, read the machine code, and we're just holding that value of the machine code while we read the registers. And while we read the register, after we read the registers, after we have those values, we're just holding that value while we calculate, an addition if it's an add instruction. And so we're really following this kind of approach right now in our processors. And we'd like to get closer to this sort of obviously better approach, where we say, once I'm done reading the machine code for one instruction, can't I read it for the next instruction while the first instruction does its actual work? So that's the idea we're going to go through. And if we do this right, it seems like it should be 3 times faster for 3 stages. And by faster, I don't mean that we actually finish everything faster, but it's overall more efficient. And we'll talk about exactly how much more efficient it is. Talk about how much more efficient it is. The first thing we need to look at is that this isn't sort of perfectly efficient. If we think about, am I getting full use out of my washer? No. There's time when I can't use my washer in this setup. And this diagram is actually probably pretty unrealistic. It's suggesting that my washer is not only very fast, but about as fast as my dryer, which is really unrealistic. And more likely, my dryer would be a bunch slower. We have a lot more time when we couldn't use the washer, just because the washer is a lot faster than the dryer. And this sort of thing is going to happen in our processor, that some parts of that instruction, running the instruction, are going to be a lot faster. And that means that we're not going to be able to take full advantage of how fast they are. We're going to be waiting for the slowest thing. And in the case of our laundry example, probably the slowest thing is the dryer. It just takes forever. And that's going to determine how fast we can do loads of laundry. It's not going to help me if I figure out how to fold things 2 times faster. I'm still going to be doing my loads of laundry basically at the same speed. And with this waste here, an observation we can have about sort of how efficient this is that if you ask me, do my loads of laundry as fast as possible, you could make a reasonable argument that this approach here doesn't do that. And why would I say that? Well, right now, each load of laundry, once we get past, you know, the startup, and once we're in the swing of things, here on this diagram here, it takes 2.1 hours. And if we didn't have to have that waiting for the dryer, it would be faster. And we'll call this time for measuring efficiency from when something starts to when something finishes, the latency. That's going to be our name for that measurement of performance. So by doing this pipelining, because not every stage takes the same amount of time, we end up having a higher latency. Like each load of laundry, or in our processor, each instruction takes longer than it would otherwise. And that if your goal was run each instruction from beginning to end as fast as possible, or do each load of laundry from starting to finishing as fast as possible, this approach is actually wrong. But if you're thinking of laundry, none of you would suggest seriously that please don't do this, since you're doing your loads of laundry slower, because our goal isn't actually to do each load of laundry as fast as possible. Our goal is to do all the loads of laundry as fast as possible. And in our processor, the same kind of thing is true. Our goal isn't to run each instruction of the program as fast as possible. You don't actually care how fast the I remove Q or the add is. You care how fast your program is. And your program has millions of instructions to run, most likely. So you care about how fast those million instructions are. And that's where this approach is going to have its advantage. We're talking about lots of instructions, you know, analogous to multiple loads of laundry. That's where we're going to have a speed up. We're not actually running each instruction faster. Now, if we want to figure out like how much better is it, we're going to have to measure our speed in some way other than this latency idea, other than looking at from start to finish. And we'll call that the measurement of sort of the speed of doing many things throughput. And one way we can measure it is we can look at the time between when we finish, or in this case, loads of laundry. That here, I'm finishing a load of laundry every 0.8 hours. So that gives me 1.2 loads of laundry I complete per hour. And when we have a full pipeline, sort of the speed is determined by our slowest stage, in this case, our dryer. So everything after the dryer, you know, only happens at the rate of the dryer because it's waiting for the dryer. Even though I could fold more things in this time, I don't have more things to fold because I'm waiting for the dryer to get them to me. And everything before the dryer is also determined by the speed of the dryer because, you know, I might have another load I could do here, but what am I going to do with it when it, if it finishes? You know, I still need to wait for the dryer. There's no point in starting it earlier. It's not going to help me. So the overall speed is determined by our slowest stage, and we'll get the same rate if I measure the time between when we finish our loads and the time between when we start our loads. I get the same throughput. They're just different ways of measuring the same thing. And it also got the same thing if I measure the time between when we start things in the mid, start some stage in the mid. It's always going to be the same, you know, as far as how fast we can go once we get started. Questions? About sort of our overall pipelining idea. And we have our two measurements, latency and throughput. Yes? So understand throughput. So throughput is trying to give us a way of measuring the intuition that we want to do loads of laundry in this way because it's faster. But to say it's faster, we can't say an individual load is faster, so we're saying how much time does it take us to do a lot of loads? Which is why my typical, a way I'll often measure throughput, but not the only way, is I'll say how many things are we doing per unit time? Right. And the way I'm measuring it, I'm sort of just saying how often are we starting or finishing things, assuming we're just doing them all the time. And the contrast in this to latency is that latency is like how long does it actually take from when I put something in my process, so I start a load of laundry to when I finish it. When we're measuring throughput, we don't care about latency. Like, I'm saying I'm finishing more than a load an hour, I'm going to say that even if each load actually takes like 10 hours. Because what I'm optimizing for, if I'm optimizing for throughput, is getting a lot of stuff done, even if each individual thing, you know, is going to take a long time. Because I'm doing a big quantity, doing it in bulk. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So we have our sort of notion of pipelining for this physical scenario, and we want to apply it to a circuit. I'm going to start with a very simple circuit we're going to apply this idea to, which is a very silly way of multiplying something times 3. I say very silly because you might remember, think, oh, we could do bit shifting here, and that would be a lot more efficient. But just for sake of having an example, this is a very silly way of multiplying times 3 using two additions. And we have our input A here, and we put A into both of the inputs of these adders. This adder here outputs 2 times A, and then we have the second adder takes 2 times A and A to get 3 times A. And if we put in 7, well, what's going to happen is, well, we're going to have the number 7 here, and the number 7 here, the number 7 here. This first adder is going to take some amount of time to, once it gets these two 7s as input, to compute 14 as its output. And once it does that, we're going to have 14 and 7 sitting on the second adder, and then the second adder, once it has those inputs stable, is going to take some amount of time and compute 21 as our final output. And if we look at this sort of timeline, it suggests that, oh, this seems like a case where we can apply that pipelining concept. That once we've computed 14 here, we could really do some stuff if we wanted to multiply other things times 3 in that space we have left over there. And that's going to be our goal, to add pipelining, that idea that after we do add 7 and 7, now let's add some other two numbers rather than just having this first adder basically sitting idle half the time. Because right now it looks like, you know, we spent half our time adding our two inputs, and then we're not doing anything until we get our next inputs, which isn't going to happen until we finish the whole first calculation. So right now, our circuit has 100 picoseconds latency, let's say. Did I actually label this? Yes. 100 picoseconds latency. That's our time from when we put in a 7 to when we get 21 out. And we get about 10 results in nanosecond, therefore. And that's our throughput. So our goal is going to be to increase that 10 results in nanosecond to more than 10. That we should be able to put in a number roughly every 50 picoseconds and get a new result. It will still take at least 100 picoseconds to compute each result, so our latency won't decrease, but we should get results more often. So sort of the overall timeline we get is that right now, we input 7, we get 21 100 picoseconds later, and then we can start inputting a next number, let's say 17, to get 51, and then 4 to get 12, and so on. That's sort of what we can do with the original circuit. And if we do pipelining, what we'd imagine we could do is something like input 7 to get 14. And then after we get 14, we can input 17 and start the next step right away. And this should be a lot more efficient. So, a problem with just doing this is that if we look at our original circuit, I told you that during this time, our adder isn't doing anything. And our first adder actually is doing something, which is that it's holding the value 14 for us. That it's kind of storing the value 14, making sure it continues to be sent on this wire. And if we went to adder to start computing something else, well, that's going to change what's on there, and that's going to mess up our second adder and make it so it can't actually compute 14 plus 7. It's going to be computing, you know, some other thing. Another problem we have is that we want this to compute 14 plus 7 and not 14 plus whatever our next input is, and it seems like our inputs are tied together here. So our solution for this is that we're going to have some places to store values in between our steps. Because right now we're storing those values, but we're kind of doing it implicitly. We're storing the value by having it on the same wire as the input here, storing the value for the second stage. We're storing the value by having the adder continue to output it after it computes it the first time and not change it. So the way I'm going to do that is I'm going to add registers. So I'm going to have a register here to store the value of 2 times A that was computed previously. So while I'm computing a new 2 times A value in my first adder, I can use the old one for the next step. And similarly, I'll have a register here to store the input from the previous step while I have a new input that I'm working on in the first adder. And I've also added registers sort of before and after this on the assumption that, you know, oh, since we're moving on from input to input, I actually want to like put the input somewhere so I can move on to the next step right away. So this idea of having these registers between stages is going to help us, you know, make our pipelining idea work in circuits. If we don't do that, then you know, we can't actually, you know, do one stage to the next because we'll have the inputs interfering with actually doing our second addition, for example. So we'll see this pattern that we'll have our different stages in our operation separated by these registers, where the idea is that the registers hold the inputs to the stage and make sure they don't change as the previous stage is now doing something else. So the timeline we want to end up with, and I'm showing the values of our registers here, is that initially we put 7 on this A T plus 2. The T plus 2 is indicating, you know, the time at which it corresponds to, you know, the output. So this T plus 2 is going to be the output in 2 time ticks, because we have T plus 0 here. So we put in 7 here, and we have 7 and 7. So initially we have 7 and 7 and 7 being input here. That's going to result in, during this time right here, that we have 14 as input to our green register here, and 7 as input to the A T plus 1 register. And then we're going to have a rising edge of the clock. Right? So to make this work, we're going to have a clock cycle, the rising edge. And after that rising edge, we're going to end up in the next stage. And this 14 is going to be copied into the register. So this register is going to be outputting 14. And the other register is going to be outputting 7. Which means our adder is going to have, our second adder is going to have 7 and 14 as inputs, and is going to therefore compute 21. And in the meanwhile, according to this timing diagram here, that our input over here has changed to 17. So we're going to have Instead of 7, we're going to have 17 as input to the adder and that bottom register. We're going to compute 17 plus 17 to get 34. And then we're going to have another rising edge of the clock and go to the next clock cycle, in which case this 34 is going to get copied over as the output, and this 17 also as the output of that register, and this 21 as our final output, and so on. So that's sort of the operation. Remember that each of the registers, they get an input during the clock cycle before that rising edge, and it gets copied at the rising edge. And we can infer from that our clock cycle looks like this, that there's a rising edge of the clock each time all the register values change. And that change is just happening because the clock signal says, read your inputs now. And as presuming we set up the clock signal correctly, that rising edge will happen at a point in time when we have our result of the addition ready, so we don't have any problems with reading values that are sort of only half computed. And because we're using registers, we don't have to worry about, say, this adder here having an input which changes while it's doing its computation. It's going to stay the same from that one rising edge to another, and that should be long enough for it to do its computation without getting weird intermediate results from the inputs changing. So questions? Yes?
If previously it took 3 cycles to perform a time-free computation, and now after the pipeline, we're performing an average of 1 per cycle, is that our new measure of efficiency?
So the question is, if previously it took 3 cycles and now it takes an average of 1, is that our measure of efficiency? So our measure of efficiency would be how many are we performing per unit time. So the problem with using cycles for that is that our cycle time is going to change depending on how fast we need to change the values of these registers. So we're going to set the cycle time based on how much stuff we have between registers. So in our original circuit, let's say, I didn't draw any registers, but let's say we had a register here and here. In that case, we'd still be doing 1 per cycle, but we'd set our cycle time much longer to handle the fact that we have to do 2 adds in that cycle instead of 1. So to actually figure out how much longer it is, we're going to need to think about how short can we set the cycle time. And does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And so the naive notion of how short it would be is you'd say, oh, well, we've cut it in half, right? Previously we needed to fit 2 adds in the cycle, and now we need to fit 1. And it's approximately that, but it's not quite that good. And it's not quite that good because we kind of glossed over something about how registers work. And registers, we've told you, oh, when we have this rising edge, there's sort of an instantaneous point in time at which the register copies its input to its output. But registers are physical things, and physical things don't actually work instantaneously. So registers have what I'll call tolerances, meaning that there's some amount of time before that rising edge during which the input cannot change. Or if it does, the register might not store the same value consistently. And there's some time after that rising edge during which the output will be changing because the register is switching from one value to another. And we'll call the total amount of time for both of these things the register delay. And the register delay, it's small, it's not 0. And this is going to mean that we can't actually divide the time in half because we have to have the register delay included. And that register delay is not going to be divided in half. Even though we're doing, we have half the time for the adding, because we're doing half as much adding in each cycle now, we don't have half the time for the register delay. We have the same register delay. Okay, so questions on register delay? So let's say our register delay is 10 picoseconds, which I've drawn on this diagram by saying that each of these registers needs 10 picoseconds. That's the time around the rising edge to do their, to get, have the input be stable, to let the output change. And our adders need 50 picoseconds. And my question is, what is our minimum cycle time? So if I'm making our clock cycle, I get to decide, I'm generating this signal, how far is between two rising edges? So my question is, what is the minimum I can set that to and still have this work? Who would like some more time? Okay, a couple people. Let's discuss it by yourself, see if you turn it off. Okay, let's see what people think. So let's start, who thinks A, that 50 picoseconds? B, 60? Pretty much for that. B, should be right, okay. Okay, C, 65. Okay, D70. Okay, Q for that. E130. Thinks we should have a different answer that's not listed here. Okay, no clue. A couple of people have no clue. Most people have opinions, and we're kind of split between 60 and 70. So sort of our question is the amount of time, does it include one register, or does it include two registers? And so the way I like thinking about it is, we look at our diagram about what the register delay means. The register delay was this time around the rising edge of the clock. So if I draw what happens here, I have my register delay for my first one register is sort of this time around that rising edge of the clock, right? We have the time before, the input needs to be stable, the time after. And that's our 10 picoseconds. And we have another register delay for the next register, going from the next to the next stage, which is going to be another thing around the rising edge of the clock. And this describes sort of what needs to happen in our cycle. And in between, we need all the stuff that's between two registers. So this needs to include all the calculations between our two registers, which is, in this case is our adder. And like this, we can think of as this register, and this we can think of as this register. And so if we count both register delays, we're counting more than a cycle, because we're including time, a bit of time after and a bit of time before that that first and last rising edge. And we want to count just a cycle. So the way we do that is I count from the beginning of one register delay to the beginning of the next register delay. So I'm not counting from rising edge to rising edge, but I'm counting the same amount of time, just shifted over a little bit. And that gives me that I would have, that's counting this time. I could have also counted it the other way, but I'm including the register plus all the stuff it feeds up to the next register. Another way of thinking about this is that I'm measuring that I know in a cycle we go from this register over to this register, so I want to like include half of the register delay on each end. Or alternately, I can measure the clock cycle by saying I'm going to measure the time it takes to go from just after this register to just after the next register, and that's going to be a cycle because I'm in the same place relative to the registers in each point. And I can do the same thing with saying just before the register. But in all these cases, I'm going to measure 60 picoseconds, so one adder plus one register delay. And we can think of that register delay of kind of being split up in our clock cycle between the inputting registers and the outputting registers. So that gets me my 60 picoseconds of clock cycle time, and I'm going to finish 1 multiplied by 3 every 60 picoseconds, so my throughput is 16 billion operations per second. Okay, some questions? Okay. So I've made my times 3 not twice as fast, but close to twice as fast. Why not twice as fast? Because previously it was like 110 picoseconds per operation. So it's not quite twice as fast, but it's close. And something we might say is, well, why don't we just keep doing this? I can just add some more registers and divide this up into 3 stages. Sorry, 4 stages. So I'm going to take my 2 values, I'm going to do part of the add, I'm going to store the intermediate results of the add, and then I'm going to do the rest of the add in the next stage. And in this way, I can do these twice as fast, almost. Not quite twice as fast, but close to twice as fast, right? So that's a theory I have here. So just storing some partial results in the middle of the adders. You know, and our hope would be that we divide the ad in half, so we have 25 picoseconds of stuff, and a register delay, so on. And you know, if this worked, we'd end up with that our cycle time would be 35 picoseconds, and it'd be still faster. So this is what we'll call a deeper pipeline. We have more stages. So there's two problems with this. So one problem is, well, what's the limit to this? How much faster can we actually get? And the other problem is, well, can we actually do this thing I said of dividing the adder in half? Like, yes, there's some intermediate results. Can I divide it up so it looks like this? Oh, and I did the computation. Well, that was smart of me not looking ahead of my slides. So our throughput now should be 1 over, so once you, A, B, C, good. We all saw that I neglected to ask that question. But remember, it's beginning, like the way, one way I can think of this is I'm doing just before register to just before register for my computation. Don't get confused and try to include this. So we have a faster thing. Okay. So question is, how much faster can we get? Okay, so let's think about that. And if we think about sort of taking this to its limit, we end up with having more and more registers, and the register delay doesn't change, right? The register is as efficient as we can make it. And let's say our register delay is 10 picoseconds. So like we start out with 110 picoseconds per cycle, then we get down to 60, then 43, and so on. But sort of in our limit, our cycle time is going to be dominated by that register delay. And, you know, adding more and more stages isn't going to help very much because I'm just getting my cycle time sort of asymptotically closer and closer to my register delay. And so the general pattern we'll see with pipelining is adding stages initially is going to be very helpful. It's going to give us almost a 2x speed up. Not quite a 2x speed up, but once we're getting close to that register delay, adding stages, in, even if everything is ideal, is going to give us a very small improvement. And I'm showing this in terms of sort of what our cycle time is. Another way we might view this is the number of operations per second, where again, we have sort of this asymptotic behavior where the, our sort of asymptote is the maximum rate at which we can update a register. Questions about this sort of diminishing returns? Yes.
Is there an associated downside with adding registers?
So is there an associated downside with adding registers? They take up space, power, but probably the bigger issue with doing that, adding a bunch of registers, is going to be the second part, which is that there's some other practicalities in the non-register parts. Right, so I've talked about we can add registers, but what about the rest of the circuit? Like, we're talking about, you know, in this diagram, dividing up our ad in our 50 picosecond ad into 1 picosecond pieces. And that's actually pretty challenging. Right? Our ad probably doesn't have a structure that makes it easy enough to divide into arbitrarily small chunks. And even if we wanted to divide it in half, probably it doesn't divide up cleanly. Often we'll end up with some sort of scenario where we can divide it in half, but one of the halves is a little slower than the other, right? We didn't divide it precisely in half just because there wasn't a convenient place to do that. So we ended up with some sort of uneven division. So, question here is, so let's say the second ad, I couldn't divide it up into two 25 picosecond pieces, so I divided it up into a 30 and a 20. Still pretty good. What's my throughput now? you ran it, check with your neighbors, see if you agree on what should our throughput be now. And throughput would be, remember, in operations per seconds. Who'd like some more time? So any volunteers to tell me what should our throughput be? So I guess maybe if it will help, our before our throughput was 1 over 35 picoseconds. So one operation for every 35 picoseconds. So what is it going to be now? Anyone? Yes. Okay, so one operation for every 40 picoseconds. So how did you get that?
I chose the largest.
Chose the largest. So largest time. So we have a bunch of things here which sort of measure things we have to get done in the cycle. So one thing we have to get done in the cycle is going through this register in this half of the adder. Another thing is going through the next register in the other half of the adder. We have all these choices. We want to take the longest one because we're going to set our cycle time long enough to handle the slowest thing. Just like in our initial laundry example, like the dryer determined how fast we could do everything else. Here, the slowest stage is going to determine how fast we can do everything else. So our slowest stage is here. So this is going to be, so this is our 40 picoseconds is going to determine our time. And we didn't get any benefit out of making a stage shorter because we have this long, new longest stage. That's going to determine our time. So our throughput is going to be one for every 40 picoseconds. So questions about how to figure that out? Okay. And I would say that this picture of, oh, we divided the out in half and we got a 30-20 split instead of 25-25 is pretty optimistic, actually. That often we'll divide things in half and we'll end up in two pieces that might total up to more total time because, like, they previously overlapped and in separate stages they don't anymore. And so when we're adding stages, often we'll get much worse returns than that. And this is probably the big reason, you know, biggest reason why we can't just, you know, keep adding more and more registers, less than the cost of the adding the registers, is because we can't divide up the work in a way which makes sense for doing that once we get beyond a certain point. So questions about splitting things unevenly? Okay, so we've talked about this idea of pipelining, sort of doing one stage and the next, a sort of assembly line kind of idea with our laundry example first, and then with our sort of arbitrary circuits. Now we're going to apply it to our actual processor, which is the whole goal. And to do that, we're going to use our textbook stages. So remember, initially, this was a conceptual order, which wasn't the real order things happened because we learned all these writes here happen at the end of the cycle. So now we're going to change it to a real order with pipeline stages, but we're going to make a few changes as we do that. So the changes are going to look, end up looking like this. So the biggest thing is that we're combining the fetch and PC update into one stage. You might say, why would we do that? When I'm thinking about running an instruction by hand, updating the program counter is the last thing I do. Why would I want to do it with fetch? Well, the reason why is that we can't fetch the next instruction until we know where it is. So if we want to start the next instruction right away, our equivalent of the next load of laundry, we need to compute that new PC right away. Now, a bigger complaint you might have, which is a good one, is, wait a moment, wasn't the reason this PC update was here was because sometimes, you know, we might read the return value, return address here from the return instruction, and here, aren't we not reading it in time? Like, this is not a conceptual order anymore. This is the real order. Aren't we not reading it in time? And the answer is yes. And that's a problem. And we're going to fix it later. We're just going to ignore that problem for now. But there's a problem here that we don't actually always know what the next program counter is early enough. We don't have the information. We're going to ignore that problem for now, and we'll solve it later. And our solution is going to make things slower, of course. But for now, we're just going to ignore that problem because we need to have something to fetch next. Okay, so questions about our new stages. Okay, so I'm going to start going through what our processor will look like with pipeline stages by starting with just a processor that runs add queue. So this doesn't have a memory stage because there's no data memory we're using yet. And we're just going to work through what is pipelining this look like. And note that we have a lot of things that aren't just our adder now. So I have my fetch and PC update stage here. I have my decode stage, my execute stage, and my write back stage. I've sort of just drawn over where those are in our processor. And I'm going to make a change to this drawing to before I separate the stages out and put registers between them. So one thing you might notice is I'm sending a value from my fetch stage directly to my write-back stage. And we want, when we're thinking about adding pipelining, to have it always be I go from fetch to decode to execute, just I go in order. That my signals go in order from one stage to the next stage, never skipping a step. Because otherwise, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some values from one instruction and some values from another instruction and put them together. I always want to keep all the values from an instruction together. So to do that, I'm going to redraw this signal, which skips over two stages, and therefore would come from a different instruction than this one once we add pipelining, because we'll have one instruction in fetch and a different instruction being executed. So I'm going to redraw it like this, just so it goes through what goes from fetch to decode to execute to write back. Every signal goes through each stage. We never skip. They always are together. So we don't have two different instructions mixed with each other. It's always one instruction's values moving from one stage to the next. So once I've done this, I'm going to now add registers between each of my stages because I want to hold the values we computed in fetch while fetch does something else. I want to hold the register values we read from decode while decode does something else. I want to hold the values we computed in execute while we add some other values. So I'm adding registers to support this. I said everything that crosses into this stage goes in a register. Questions? So that's my processor, and I'm going to name these sets of registers, which I'll call register banks, by the pairs of stages there between. So I have fetch decode between fetch and decode execute between decode and execute. In this case, execute write back between execute and write back because we have no memory stage. And we can kind of consider our PC as a special case of this, which goes from fetch to fetch, but it's actually going between two different instructions. So here's my pipeline processor now. So let's walk through how it executes these two instructions, adder 8 or 9, adder 10 or 11. So first, I'm going to have the machine code for outer inner 9 retrieved. I'm going to get as inputs here 8 and 9, the two register numbers from the instruction. I'm also going to get the address of the second instruction as input to my PC register. Then we're going to have a rising edge of the clock, and we're going to move on to the next instruction. So the way that's going to work is now these 8s and 9s will be copied to the outputs of our fetch to decode registers. And our PC's output will now be the address of instruction 2, and presumably the input will be the address of any instruction 3. And since we have 8 and 9 coming out of here, our register file is going to be getting 8 and 9 as the register indices to read, and we're going to have the value of register 8 and register 9 coming out of the register file and going into the decode to execute registers. So then, I'm going to have a rising edge of the clock. We're going to copy the value of register 8 and 9 here, and also we have 10 and 11 from our new instruction to copy into these registers, and that's going to look like this. We have 10 and 11 now being output here while from instruction 2. So instruction 2 is here, while instruction 1's values have moved to the decode execute register, so instruction 1 is adding those values. So we're going to have the actual sum of R8 plus R9 being input to the execute to write back registers, while we have the actual values of R10 and R11 being input to the decode to execute. Then we'll have a rising edge of the clock, and we're going to advance further, and we're going to have the first instruction doing its write back, sending things to the register file to write, while the second instruction is doing its execute. And the general pattern we see is that the second instruction is always behind the first one by a stage, and if there's a third instruction behind that by another stage, and so on. Yes?
What would happen if you kept the first line the same, add R8, R9, but then the second one we did add R9, R8?
The question is, what would happen if instead of these two instructions using this different registers, some of them use the same registers, we would compute the wrong values? We will talk about fixing that in a later lecture. So, if we think about this whole process with more instructions, this is just another way of visualizing. I'm just showing the values of the registers at different times. So initially, we have our PC outputting the address of the first instruction here. Because of that, it computes as inputs here the two register numbers. So during the next cycle, our PC is handling the next instruction, but our fetch decode registers are outputting 8 and 9, so we can read the registers for the first instruction while we're fetching the second. So our first instruction has moved on in cycle 1 to fetch decode. That's going to move on to adding its values in cycle 2 while we're fetching the third instruction and while we're reading the registers for the second instruction, and so on. And we always have this pattern of one instruction being behind the other. So we can kind of, on this sort of timeline of register values, we can see the instructions go through stage by stage, and we can see their values in different cycles in the different stages registers. And we're going to have a bunch of things to talk about with pipelining. So some of them is fixing the issues we've mentioned of, oh, this doesn't always quite work because of dependencies between instructions. And another is going to be thinking about, well, how fast actually is this going to be? And we'll talk about those over our next few lectures.